name is Itir and I'm Jirfa Mitra in Melbourne. And I'm here with Buddha Dasa and we're going to talk, we'll have a conversation for the 50 Years, 50 Voices project. I have a few questions and some of them are about change and how things have changed. But I guess it would be good to start with, how did your Dharma life start, Buddha Dasa? Was there a certain point that you thought, oh, this is the beginning of something?
I find that a very interesting but also quite a difficult question. Because it's tied in with awareness and a sense that there is a purpose or a destiny in one's life. I think it began for me when I was about 8 years old, and we lived in the country in Devon, and I was on my own down a country lane, not very far from our house, and I was looking up and watching the wind in the trees above my head. And suddenly I had this experience, which I can now, in retrospect, define as a mystical experience, where I, as it were, saw a segment or a section of the wheel of life. And it was as if from my parents and their parents and their parents too, I could see back into the darkest and dimmest, most reaches of time itself. And then coming forward again, I could see that with my parents, that my sense of continuity was ending. I was not going to, in other words, I was not going to get married. I was not going to have children. And so therefore, the line that I could see in this vision would not be perpetuated by me. If you like, it was a little glimpse of samsara in terms of the procreation of the human species. And the sense of destiny and insight that I had at that time applied to me in the sense that I would not be propagating the human condition anymore in terms of samsara. And the rest of my life, up to the time I met Banti and the Dharma, was for, in a sense, a search, just looking for a confirmation of that experience, which I eventually did find within Buddhism. Although for a while, until I was 21, I did consider myself to be a Christian.
And how did that end, your faith in Christianity? Was there an, did that have a definite end, or was it when you found
Buddhism? It did have quite a definite end, but what I valued in Christianity was it gave me a sense that there was something other than one's own immediate experience and one's own social existence. And I maintained my Christian belief and loyalty even right through my army career, which lasted for about 5 years. And it was only after the fact that once I brought myself out of the army, I was in Salisbury Cathedral on one occasion, where my brother, incidentally, was a chorister at that time. And I used to go along with the family and sit in the choir stall, enjoying some of the services of Christianity and that particular cathedral with beautiful singing. And on one occasion, on the recitation of the Apostles' Creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty, where everybody in the congregation stands up and faces the altar and recites the Apostles' Creed, I gagged on the first sentence. And it came upon me quite unexpectedly, but I knew I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe a word of it. And I therefore failed to recite the Apostles' Creed on that occasion and any subsequent occasion. And I didn't feel guilty for that. It didn't worry me at all. I left that cathedral with a sense of freedom that I had never experienced before regarding my Christian belief and conditioning.
And then how did you meet the Dharma?
Well, I go into this a little bit in my little booklet on the first rung. I first came across Buddhism in my climbing career, which I enjoyed after I left the army. I had a friend who and a fellow climber who was interested in Zen poetry. And after we climbed somewhere or other, sitting on a cliff, we would just sit and talk poetry, and particularly Zen poetry. And that led into ideas of, you know, Zen masters and the Dharma. And I started to read a little bit about Buddhism, particularly from initially the Zen point of view. And I cultivated then an interest in meditation, and I tried to practice it from a book. What is it called? Three Pillars of Zen? I can't remember now. And I moved up to London. I'm cutting a long story short here. And eventually a friend of mine said that he knew of somebody teaching meditation. And this particular person turned out to be Sangharakshita. And I've never looked back.
Do you remember when you first met him?
Oh, yes, very well. A winter's evening towards the end of 1969. And I can see myself now walking up Monmouth Street, trying to find number 14 where I knew these meditation classes were being held, and finding this little shop called Sakura. And there was no sign indicating that meditation was taught in this little building. But the door was open and it led down into a passageway. Everything was silent. There's no other person about. So I entered and walked down the passageway, past the shop entrance, which was on my left, and came to another door or entrance that led down into the basement. You couldn't see into the basement because the stairs below curved around under the floor. But there's a light down there. And I couldn't hear a thing. I just wondered what was going on. But I said, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, let's go down the stairs and see what's going on down there, if anything. So I went down the stairs and turned left into one of the rooms at the bottom. And there, seated at the far end of a small room, was this figure wearing a robe. He had long, dark, glossy hair down to his shoulders. He was wearing also a Western pullover under his robes. This was quite distinct. Also quite noticeable was the abundance of rings that he had on his finger. And he gave me a smile of welcome. And I said, good evening. May I join you? Prophetic words indeed, because I have never left him since.
And what did you look like then?
Well, I was a product of that time. I can't remember exactly what I was wearing, but my own hair was down to my shoulders, and I very much enjoyed the alternative movement that was being created at that time. I may have been wearing my well-loved velvet sky blue jacket. Certainly I had flared trousers, maybe a psychedelic tie, a coloured shirt. And this was quite normal. We didn't think this was strange. But now looking at the photographs of those times, particularly the photograph of my ordination, which occurred about 2 years later, when my hair is hanging over my face, you can hardly see my face with all this hair. We were a hairy lot at that time.
And what happened in those 2 years, you know, since the day that you went into that room and do your ordination?
Well, I could almost write a book about what happened in those 2 years. Very soon after I met Manti, I decided that this is how I wish to spend my life.
What do you mean by this when you say this is?
Well, I met Manti and I understood very quickly what he was trying to do. He was trying to communicate the Dharma to the West and bring the Buddha's teaching to the West. And I related to that. I understood the Dharma. I knew what he was trying to do. And I felt I could not do anything more worthwhile than try to help him. Although at that time he did not achieve the stature that he later took on in my awareness. At that time he was just a monk who had come over to England, having been, as it were, born an Englishman, to try to communicate the Buddha's teaching. I thought, well, what could be better? What could be more worthwhile? And his spiritual qualities, his enormous abilities in terms of friendship, scholarship, erudition, wisdom, I wasn't aware of that. Everything that he'd done in India, I wasn't even aware of. He was just a monk. A few weeks after I'd met him, I said, look, Manti, I can either help you financially, because at that time I was working with a firm of architects in London, not very well paid, but sufficiently paid enough to be able to help him. And this was not far from Monmouth Street. It was in Bloomsbury Square. Or, I said, I could give up my work, which I was quite prepared to do, because I wasn't that attached to this particular profession of being an interior designer, and help you practically. And he just laughed and he said, you can always rely on the toss of a coin. And which is what I did. Next day at work, I tossed my coin. I can't remember which way up it was, but the result was I walked into the boss's office and said, I'm leaving. And I have never regretted that particular toss of a coin. And from then on, I helped Banti in practical ways and we tried to get the movement up and running. Soon afterwards, I asked him to go for refuge. I didn't ask him for ordination because that language wasn't being used at that time. And in a sense, I had no sense of joining the order because the order was very small, even a little bit fragmented. So I asked him to go for refuge in the traditional sense with him and to the three jewels. And he said, fine, that's fine. And I felt accepted in that request. But then he said, I'm not going to ordain anybody for at least 2 years because I've been so disappointed in the first two batches. So I think, well, fair enough. I mean, I've been accepted. I know that eventually I will be ordained. So I just pitched in and helped him wherever I could. Soon after that, a tearful Gotami came to visit me in my flat in Putney one day, armed with 3 slim files, and asked me to take over the chair of the FWBO. Also, as it happens, as secretary, and as I discovered later, I was also the treasurer. I think I'm the only person who can honestly say I've been chair, treasurer, and secretary of the FWBO all at the same time. And another way I helped out was on a retreat soon after all this. Andy came up to me and said, I'd like you to move to Sarum House and sort out the difficulties there. Mm. Yeah, he said he was fed up with what was going on there. And so I decided to leave my flat in Putney and move into Sarum House, which eventually became Ariotara. Mm. And this was in Croydon,
yeah.
Or Purley in Croydon. I spent a few months there.
Mm.
And it was from there that I eventually moved up to Archway, which was our first Buddhist centre that we had of our own, that we rented from Camden Council.
Mm. When was this?
Around about 1973.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't quite remember the exact date. Yeah.
But you've been ordained by then?
I was ordained in 1972.
Okay. Yes,
yeah. In April
1972.
Mm. Mm. So soon after that, we discovered this derelict building in Archway that we converted into our new and first centre.
Mm. I have a question around who was the first order member you really met, and I'm wondering, would you say your way into the Sangha was directly through Bhante, or was there another order member?
No, not really. No, it was Bhante primarily. The first order member who helped me was Dhammapala. He was around at that time. And he taught me to meditate, the mindfulness of breathing, at least that practice. Bhante happened to be away on one occasion, and it was when I turned up, it was Dhammapala, to whom I've always been very grateful. And the only other order member that I had any real contact with was Gotami. And she was very loyal and very supportive of Bhante, but was struggling as well, particularly with her living situation at Sarum House, as it was then. So there's no one apart from Bhante with whom I can say I had a Kalyanamitra type relationship with. In fact, that whole idea of speaking of Kalyanamitra came much later.
Was friendship still really emphasised in the early days as well?
Well, it's emphasised in the sense we call ourselves friends of the Western Buddhist order.
I see.
But very few of us had any conception of what that ideal meant. I think only developed much later.
How do you think that has changed this the Sangha in terms of, I guess, the evolution of friendship and spiritual friendship?
Well, it was always there, waiting to be developed. And I think one of the things that helped it along its way was the frequency of our early retreats. Particularly communication exercises, which I feel have dropped by the wayside, unfortunately, these days. But we used to do communication exercises on a regular basis, on retreats, and even some days devoted to communication exercises in our program. And that, of course, facilitates and encourages friendship. The other thing is that on retreats, people were saying, well, why can't we live like this all the time? And out of those sorts of conversations came the idea of living together in communities and even working together. And, of course, when you live together with someone and you work together with someone, you form friendships. And if you're following the same ideal, then you have a spiritual friendship. But this was all to be discovered. And when I first came along, it wasn't in the currency of our language at the time.
Do you remember a moment? This might not apply to you because you were there early on, but do you remember a moment where you felt like you've arrived into the order or into the movement or you've kind of found your place?
I wouldn't put it like that. I don't use the language of into the order. I don't use the language of being in the order. When people ask me, or even if I think about it myself these days, I say I feel as I'm on the order. A bit like a dewdrop on a lotus leaf, free to come and go or drop off as I please. Yeah. So from my perspective, it's as though if the order has grown up around me. Yeah. But I've never felt, as it were, in the order as opposed to out of the order.
Mm.
But I do have a very close inner connection with what I call, or what is now known, as the Arya Sangha.
Mm.
But in the early days, I had no language for this.
Mm.
And I can remember quite clearly in one of my first meditation classes at Sakura, as it was then, having a very clear sense of an overarching community of fellow Dharma practitioners who have gone on before us.
Mm. Yeah.
I can only express it in that sort of way, but in whom we are also still in contact.
Mm.
And I have always felt this idea that there are Dharma practitioners, as it were, who have gone before us, with whom we are now in contact. And later, this became known to me as the Arya Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel our order collectively is in contact with the Arya Sangha.
Mm. What about your ordination? How was that? What was that like?
It was a bit casual.
Okay.
It occurred in the context of an Easter retreat at Caffolds.
Mm-hmm.
Four of us were being ordained on this occasion, and this is the first ordinations to have occurred after a 2-year period.
Mm.
As I said before, Bhante was very disappointed in the first two batches of ordinations into the Western Buddhist Order. And with me being ordained at this time, there was Vajrabodhi, Padmaraja, and Vajradhaka. I think the order was Vajrabodhi first because he was eldest, then myself, then Padmaraja, and then Vajradhaka, because you're ordained in terms of seniority. And there were only 19 other order members present, some of whom weren't active at all in terms of developing our activities and our institutions. Two of the order members present were wearing robes of their own devising. This is you can still see this in some of the photographs of the day. One was wearing a robe of his own devising in the form of a Franciscan monk. And the other guy, Ratner, he was wearing a robe of Geo Kennett Roche's Zen group in Throstle Hole. Is that right? And he'd gone off and joined and become a disciple of Geo Kennett Roche.
Mm.
Nevertheless, he turned up at my ordination.
Mm.
So the order then was incredibly fluid. And also liberal.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And yes, the ordination took place, and this was the public ordination,
mm-hmm.
which followed on from the private ordination the evening before.
Mm-hmm.
And each in our own turn went into the library at Caffolds and received from Bhante the refuges and precepts and our name.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I was very happy to hear the name Buddhadasa being passed on to me.
Mm.
Yeah. Very happy indeed. But I'm just remembering this. Convention didn't subscribe at that time that we kept our name secret after the private ordination. Nowadays, that is left for the public preceptor to announce. No, the private preceptor to announce. But I remember one of our women friends, Debbie Lobstein, came up to me, gave me a smacking kiss, and said, "What's your name?" And I said, "I told her." But it was left to Bhante to describe my name next day at the public ordination.
Mm. Yeah. And what did he say?
He made the point that Buddhadasa means, yes, servant of the Buddha, but one who is willing to be of service, and not being of service in any servile sense of that word.
Mm.
Yeah. So yes, Buddhadasa means one who is willing to be of service to the Buddha and to the ideals of enlightenment.
Has your relationship to your name changed over the years?
No.
Mm.
No.
Mm. What about your relationship with Bhante?
Oh, That certainly has changed over the years.
Mm.
And I will say that it's got better and better.
Mm.
Though there have been a few bumps along the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, I found I was having a lot of reactivity
mm-hmm.
with Banti. You know, I was reacting to him in a way that surprised me, in a way into the depths of my being. And I couldn't work out what this was all about. At the time, I was living at Padmaloka with him, and I was his secretary. And this would be in about the year 1977, 78. And eventually it got to such a pass with me, I had to go up to him and say, look, Banti, I'm afraid I just don't like you.
Wow. Yeah.
There's something about you that irritates me profoundly, your personality. And I'm finding it really difficult even living here. At that time, I also spoke with Sagramati, and I explained to him my dilemma about my feelings towards Banti, because although I didn't like him as a person, as a man, I still had utter and profound faith in him.
Mm.
I couldn't work this out. How on earth can you have faith and trust in someone whom you don't like? And Sagramati, bless him, explained to me that liking and disliking someone is a relatively superficial mental event.
Mm.
What is important is the faith, which is much more enduring and long-lasting and in a way more profound.
Mm.
And that helped me to see through the dilemma I was facing with Banti, and that I could honestly go up to him, express my feelings, but also express the fact that I still had faith in him as my teacher.
Mm.
And this was also tied in with an incident that occurred when I was asked to drive Banti into Norwich. I was also his driver at the time.
Mm.
And the Volvo broke. The Volvo car, the back axle broke. And I had to replace the back axle in the morning by pulling out the old one,
mm-hmm.
going to Norwich to get a new one from a scrapyard, putting it back into the Volvo, tightening up the wheel and all the rest of it in pouring rain to enable Banti to go to Norwich for his appointment.
Mm.
And by the end of tightening up the last screw on the wheel, I was fuming.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, I'll explain in a moment.
Mm.
And he got into the car. He didn't even say thank you. He didn't even say good morning, Buddhadasa. And I was, for want of a better expression, fuming.
Mm.
So I started to drive into Norwich. And halfway into Norwich, along the road from Sirlingham, he looked out of his own window and he said, you know, Buddhadasa, too much praise spoils the disciple. And the veils of ignorance just fell away. And I knew then exactly what had been going on.
Mm.
That I'd been looking towards Banti, in a sense, as a father figure, to some extent.
Mm.
And that what I was seeking from him was at least an acknowledgement and some praise of what it is I'd been doing and what it is I'd been committing myself to in terms of him, and perhaps not so much the Dharma.
Mm.
And on the basis of that, I went away and realized all this on a solitary retreat and came back and re-established our friendship on a much firmer and sounder footing. Mm. And that's endured to this day.
Yeah. Mm. Mm.
But in that sense, I've always considered Banti not only to be my friend, but also a Vajra Guru.
Mm.
Mm.
So he could see what you were going through.
In retrospect.
Yeah. Wow. So you never had to tell him about your difficulties with him. That just all came out in that journey, that car.
I was quite honest when I realized I couldn't continue as I was without confiding in him.
Yeah.
It's always been very easy for me to confide in Banti,
mm-hmm.
but I've never gone to him with problems or difficulties that I felt I could resolve for myself. Only once in the very, very early years did I go up to him and said, look, Banti, there's a number of our friends, order members, who are telling me that I've got psychological difficulties and problems. Mm? These are not quite clear to me. And I said, look, if I do have, could you please tell me? And I'm quite happy to work through them. But I was getting confused by the sort of feedback I was getting, a bit like you may have been talking about this morning. And he said, Buddhadasa, I want you to know that you're the most emotionally free order member we have. And that was enough. And I haven't gone to him with any other sort of knotty problem or difficulty since.
So how do you deal with
them? Well, I just work through them. It's quite clear if you have the Dharma, you've got your practice. Yes, you confront them head on. You do talk about them, you see them through. So yes, one does have difficulties. But you can get over them.
Fair enough. Okay, another question I have is around your relationship with your Yidama, or your meditation in general. How has that changed over the years?
Again, it's a bit of difficulty. When I first... I've always been keen on meditation. I don't regard myself as a meditator, but I have always valued and have maintained my meditation practice. And I've had some very interesting experiences as a consequence of my meditation practice. And I've also engaged in and pursued the 100,000 prostrations associated with Padmasambhava, the prostration going for refuge practice. So I'm no slouch when it comes to meditation practice. But as far as Yidam is concerned, things get a little bit more confusing because in the very early years, when I was going up to visit Banti in Muswell Hill and doing some study with him on a weekly basis with two or three other friends, four or five, depending on who turned up, he would go through at the beginning of each class a visualization and a mantra recitation of one or another of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas that appear in our Sevenfold Puja. So I got quite familiar with all of them, and I liked all of them, and I didn't feel I needed to choose any particular one over and above the other. So when the question of who would I like to have as my Yidam appeared, and Banti asked me this at the time of my ordination, I wasn't sure. Though I did recall at that time a sense of Amitabha being present when I was working on the development and renovation of the new centre in Archway, which is, as I said, a derelict building. And on one occasion I was there alone, working away, and I just had this sense, this presence of Amitabha, the Red Buddha. So I thought, well, I'll go for that. I'll go for him. And I said this to Banti, that yes, I'd like Amitabha. And Banti just, his face just lit up. And of course, later on I discover that Amitabha is also significant in Banti's own life and meditation practice. And nowadays, Amitabha, in a sense, is my root Yidam, if I may like, we might call it that. And I also do the Manjigosha Stuti Sadhana, which I've been doing for a number of years. And I was initiated into that by Banti as well.
How was your journey being a private and a public preceptor?
I don't consider it as a journey. It seemed almost inevitable that this would happen. And seeing it as a responsibility, people asking you to be their private preceptor, which has happened in my case, and leading on from that, becoming a public preceptor. I did push a little bit here. I said, I think I ought to be a public preceptor because there isn't one in this region. And I felt that the ordination process needed some representative in England, in the college. And I felt there's no one else. I'll put my name up, hold my hand up, as it were. And I was accepted as a public preceptor.
And how did you decide to come to Australia? We haven't talked about that much.
Well, this goes back to the famous Vinehall Convention. I think it was 1978 or 79. And my friend De Pancre came up to me. Now, De Pancre is an Australian, or was an Australian, because he's now died. And he was working with me on Friends Building Service, which was the building team that I was managing who is helping to raise funds for the development of the new London Buddhist Centre and the Sakavati complex. So we got to know each other very well. It was on this convention that he came up to me and said, "Buddhadasa, would you like to come back with me to Sydney to start a centre in Sydney in Australia?"
Mm.
And I said instantly, "Yes, a lovely idea. I'd love to do that." Yeah, mm. I didn't really have to think about it. Mm. Yeah. But I said, "One thing I have to do is to consult Banti."
Mm.
I said, "I'd just like to talk things over with him first." And Dipankar said, "No, don't bother. I already have talked to him and he thinks it's a good idea."
Mm. Mm.
So that was it. Mm. I was Australia bound.
Mm.
We left in 1980. We left England in 1980. And when I say we, that is myself, Dipankar, Dhammamati.
Mm-hmm.
And Vipula joined us, and he was a New Zealander. And all sorts of images have come floating into my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But we left England. I left with Dipankar. We travelled together by the States. We travelled through the West, up the West Coast of America.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Tahiti en route and finished up in New Zealand. And it was in New Zealand that I discovered I was persona non grata as far as entry into Australia was concerned, because there were a number of factors. The two friends who had agreed to sponsor me reneged on their sponsorship, one deliberately and one by forgetfulness.
Mm.
And it was the time when there's a bit of paranoia in Australia about cults,
mm-hmm.
and other movements. And there was an incident in Sydney, which is called the Andamaga bombing, where two people got killed with a bomb that was planted in a dustbin. So there was a sense of paranoia about spiritual movement. And I had heard subsequently that someone had written to the immigration authorities in Australia saying on no account should any member of the FWBO be allowed into Australia because they are both anti-Christian and anti-family.
Mm.
Well, if I was an immigration officer, I wouldn't have allowed myself into the country either. Yeah, it was that. So I had to stay in New Zealand. I became a resident after 3 years, and eventually I was granted citizenship.
Mm.
And I didn't leave Australia until 1987.
You mean New Zealand?
Mm.
So when did you arrive in Australia?
1987.
Okay, yeah. Mm. Mm. And not in Sydney, but you came to Melbourne.
Oh, Banti said in 1985, he wrote to me and he said, "Should you ever feel free to leave New Zealand, or whenever you feel free to leave New Zealand, I would very much like you to go to Melbourne rather than Sydney."
Mm.
Because Dipankar and Dhammamati and others seem to be doing quite well there.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
So we could do with a centre in Melbourne too.
Yeah.
So I went to Melbourne, sight unseen.
Yeah.
And came down here with, as it happened, Gunapala and Paul Kangali and Rita Darko.
Mm. Mm. And then you just started classes in the city, is that right?
Not initially. Mm. The first thing to do was find somewhere to live.
Yeah.
And I've always said in my own mind that if you want a successful centre, you'd be better off having behind you a successful community.
Mm.
Because that's from whence the energy really comes.
Mm.
And I've never had cause to alter this opinion.
Mm.
So we found a place to live. The next step, of course, was to earn money.
Mm.
So Gunapal and I went on to the building sites of Melbourne as plasterers. I'd qualified myself as a plasterer in New Zealand.
Mm.
And for the next 10 years, I earned money with a long-term view of buying our own community, this place in which we're having our interview, which was going to be the foundation and the basis for our future centre. So once we bought this place, we held classes here in our new shrine room.
Yeah.
But things had happened also previously through osmosis, and that our rented premises, people coming along and learning to meditate just because they knew and heard we were there.
Mm. Wow. Mm. And how long did it take for it to be a bit more established, do you think? Was it difficult the first couple of years?
Well, yes, it's difficult. I had to keep working. That was the difficulty, finding the time to maintain working, paying off a mortgage, at the same time trying to get a new centre up and running. But we did very quickly establish a circle of committed friends. And eventually we took the plunge and rented that premises in Pitt Street, which we converted, where we converted a factory into what was quite a functional little centre. And it was all done through hard work. But I think our first sense that we had a possibility of a centre arose through holding classes here in our community and then moving from this community to hold public classes into War Park, which is just over the road from here. And then from there, taking that big leap into the commitment to have a lease on the centre in Pitt Street.
And at the same time, I guess you were helping out at the Hills with Maitrapala and what she was doing, so there was a bit of a community.
Maitrapala turned up one day with Akashmani. To a class here in the community, and I decided after a very brief conversation with her that I would go up on a regular basis. I think it was a fortnightly basis, if not weekly, I can't really remember, and to take classes up there, because she was quite capable of organizing them, which is what she wanted to do. So rather than her coming down on a weekly basis, I went up there and we started another little group up in the Dandenongs. And out of that course has come a public preceptor. Maitrapala is now a public preceptor.
So in some ways, I guess you could just see the potential in that. It sounds like decision-making is fairly easy for you. So
I've never had difficulty making a decision. Though I have said to Banti, and I got a laugh out of Banti, saying I've never made a decision in my life. It's as though by the time I make a decision, the decision has already been made. In a peculiar sense, and I've always been able to act with promptitude. So I haven't ever had much difficulty about this or that and equivocating. I've always been fairly quick to move in a particular direction.
I have a question about your, I guess, personal practice. I'm sure there's a better way to put it, but do you feel like there's any views that you've really seen through, or things that you can see over time that has really changed in the way that you approach your Dharma life, or just life in general?
Well, one of the features of my spiritual career, in a way, it goes back to that incident I talked to you about when I was 8, and particularly since I've been ordained and a member of the order and a disciple of Banti and the Buddha, is the practice of brahmacharya. I always, in the back of my mind, have been moving towards this. Sometimes it's as if I was yearning to go back and to live in a monastery or something like that, or live the life of an anagarika, like Anagarika Dhammapala, who is one of my great heroes. But I've always had that tendency, that aspiration, to live a single and wholeheartedly and contented life. But that's not to say that one doesn't also have drives and desires associated with the old physical body, not to mention mental activity. And I'm very grateful to Vidyavati, whom I teamed up with in New Zealand. We had a relationship that lasted 13 years, though neither of us ever wanted to live together. We were quite happy just meeting up occasionally. And for a while we had a long-distance relationship. She lived in America and I was living in New Zealand and also Australia. And I've come to the conclusion that long-distance relationships are the best possible ones to have, because that means every time you meet up, you have another honeymoon. So that for me has been a sort of the sense of progress and development in my own spiritual life. Friendship, yes, consolidating friendships, appreciating friendships, appreciating Bhante more and more and more.
Mm.
And I think no regrets. That's the other thing, you know. And I'm now 75. For all its ups and downs, I feel it's been a life worth leading.
Yeah. Well, it definitely sounds like it. Yeah. What do you value about, single sex, no relationship kind of lifestyle? You know, what is it in it that you find supportive for practice?
Well, I'm very happy living on my own.
Mm.
Mm. But you can't live on your own indefinitely. You do need the support, even if it's material support, of other people. You need fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think fellowship is a little bit different from the need for support.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel the need for support. I do need the need for fellowship, or as we would say, Kalyanamitrata. I like being part of a team. I like working together with other people to achieve a common end. You can't do everything on your own, and you do need other people to work through to achieve your ideals. And I think this can come back most satisfactorily, easily, in the context of community life. And that also becomes the working ground, of course, for personal development.
Over your many years of teaching or being at centres or developing friendships, is there anything that you can see, maybe the word pitfalls that newcomers fall into, or some themes that people who are new to the Dharma?
Well, first of all, I've never considered myself to be a teacher, per se. I do teach, I do practice, but I never consider myself to be a practitioner or a teacher. So that's one point. I think your answer may be best illustrated by something I put to Bhante in a convention held in the early 90s. I can't remember the date. And I wasn't happy with this convention. And the reason I wasn't happy is that there was a lot of carrying on extracurricular activity taking place at nights. Let's say, and of which I was aware. And bonfires were being lit in woods, and there was dancing and carousing and things of this sort. It was also a convention where families were appearing, and families or some people were criticizing the order for not providing creches for families. And I thought, what have we come to? What's happening here? And I went to Bhante because I used to see him on a fairly regular basis. And I said, look, Bhante, I'm just not happy with this convention. As far as I can see, we have spent the last 35 years trying to develop a spiritual community. And all we finished up doing is ending up with a positive group. And I said, for a few days on this convention, I said, I was a bit depressed with this. I couldn't see much evidence of the spiritual community. And then I said, it dawned on me that actually there's something very positive here, because the next step is apparent and clear. The next step is the formation of the Arya Sangha. And Bhante just looked at me, he pointed his finger at me and said, that is a very good way of putting it. And I think in terms of my teaching and my experience of the order ever since has been to try to distinguish for people and even in myself between the positive group and the idea of the spiritual community. And I think in some people's minds, the idea and even the reality of the positive group is sometimes mistaken for what I define as the spiritual community. But the trick is, you can't knock the spiritual, you can't knock the positive group because it's positive. And you need the positive group for the arising of the spiritual community. The two are intimately connected, but the two ideally ought not to be confused. And I think for a while in my own mind, I couldn't see or distinguish between the one from the other. Now I can. I'm very clear in my own mind when I do see as or contrast the spiritual community with a positive group. For instance, in most centers, you will have strong elements of a positive group. Mm-hmm. And long may that be so. Mm-hmm. Cups of tea, chats and talks and, mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. People communicating, getting to know each other. But there's another dimension to this too, that we need to look for the emerging, genuine spiritual community, a community of individuals.
And where is the spiritual community?
Where? Mm. Well, in a sense, it's nowhere. It's transcendent. It doesn't have a place. It can't be defined. But its members know each other. That's why it's forgotten sometimes that the order doesn't exist, not legally. You can't find the order in legal terms anywhere. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you can't say that where the order exists or where it has its being or its base. It can only have its base in the hearts of individual order members. Mm-hmm. And that suggests those order members concerned are in contact with each other.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It's a little bit mysterious, isn't it? It's not just a collection of individuals when you talk about the spiritual community.
Mm. It's very mysterious, and I think we need to rejoice in the mystery.
Yeah.
And I hinted at that earlier when I had this intimation of the Arya Sangha and the relationship between the Arya Sangha and what we are doing today. Mm. Bhante refers to what he describes as the suprapersonal force. I haven't been particularly comfortable with that description because of the word force, though I accept it. I tend to use in my own mind a guiding principle, because I've always felt in my own life I've had a guiding principle, even from day one. Mm. And I followed that, and I still follow it. But it's as intimately connected with my life as an order member, what I'm doing, but also what the order can become.
Mm. I have a question about legacy, or what would you would like to leave?
Legacy?
Well, the term of teaching, you know, if there's a teaching that, you know, or a message you were able to leave, but what would that be?
You're asking me what my epitaph might be.
We can put it that way, or kind of like...
I don't know. I really don't know. Mm. I mean, I look back, I've had fun, did my best. Maybe that's sufficient. I'm not leaving any great writings behind me. I'm hoping I'm leaving an effect that what I've initiated here and there in various countries will endure, not because of me, but because of the people who have been involved indirectly. An ever-winding circle, the Sangha grows, but nothing specific springs to mind.
We talked about this a little bit in terms of community living, but can you speak a little bit more about what matters in living an effective Dharma life? Or do you think there's a set of conditions that are, you know, supportive of deepening one's going for refuge?
Well, I think one of the things is to find out what it is you really want to do.
Yeah.
And a lot of people struggle with this.
Yeah.
They're not sure what it is they really want to do. Mm. And that leads them into conforming and doing what other people think they ought to do. I've always had quite a strong sense of, in a way, doing what I really want to do. And when I first met Bhante, I very quickly understood that what he was trying to do conformed with what I was looking to do. Yeah. Mm. So all my energies were available instantly and to help him. And that's always been the case, even to today. So I think that will continue. Mm-hmm. I don't see myself... So what was the sort of question again?
Well, the question is, you know, the conditions for other people, but I think this is... You know, you're talking about the same thing. It's kind of finding out what you want to do. And for you in the future, what does it look like? What is it that you want to do?
Well, I've done quite a lot in my order life. Mm. that we're talking now about the spiritual life, and I don't see the fact I'm old is going to diminish what it is I really want to do. And I thought quite a lot about, you know, death and rebirth and things like this, and that doesn't bother me any at all. You know, I'm not fazed about the idea of death. The manner of dying might be a bit messy, but death itself doesn't particularly worry me. And I do see that I'm on a path that is continuing and will continue over and above death, physical death. You know, I take great heart from, you know, what Bhante has managed to achieve and establish. And he himself has said that something to the effect that the effects of his life here and what he's done in establishing order won't be fully appreciated for about 200 years.
Wow.
Something along those lines, yeah.
Yeah.
And we are still very, very small.
We're just about the end of the questions, but I have a kind of, this is my personal interest question that I'm going to sneak in. It will probably be the last question unless you can, if there's anything else you want to talk about. But I'm really interested in general about this, but specifically what you think about the Bodhisattva ideal and how that plays out in your life and in the order in more general terms.
I was very inspired when I first heard the concept. And I think for a lot of people, the Bodhisattva ideal just articulates what so many people feel within them. You know, the urge to do good for the betterment of everybody. But there's a catch to it, that you first of all have to sort yourself out first. Yes, it's to do with the whole process or the intimacy between giving and transcendence. The act of giving means that in a way you are in touch, or the subject, object, are blended in the act of giving, which is a form of transcendence. And so the spiritual life begins with dana, giving, and that suggests the whole concept of the Bodhisattva ideal. We don't speak very much about the Bodhisattva ideal these days, do we? Not to the same degree. You know, Bhante's got this series of the Bodhisattva ideal. And tied in with that, I'm just thinking about it, in the very early years, I'm just thinking, you know, 10, 20 years of the movement as we were developing, I was very inspired, and in a way I still am inspired, by the revolutionary side to the Dharma. You cannot practice the Dharma without being a revolutionary. Or you cannot practice the Dharma wholeheartedly, let's say, without being a revolutionary. And that means sooner or later people are going to get offended. And that's the clue that you're succeeding. It is even said that the Buddha himself created enemies. And I think on one occasion he said it's impossible to practice a spiritual life without creating enemies. And that doesn't mean to say one should go around creating enemies deliberately and thereby say you're practicing the spiritual life. But I do regret the revolutionary edge of what we are doing in Triratna seems to have diminished. We are moving into a realm of consensus teaching. We don't teach unless it's acceptable to the people that we are teaching. I think we should teach because it's unacceptable to the people we're teaching. There's a revolutionary edge, there's a transforming edge to what it is we have undertaken. I think we're beginning to all have lost sight to some extent of that.
Do you have an idea why that might be happening?
No, I don't, not really. People like to play it safe. People don't like to cause offence. People don't like to be thought of as unpopular. People don't like to have people disagreeing with them. I wouldn't like to see that happening on an institutional level. For instance, I've been a bit disappointed. I said this at the weekend in Port Fairy, that I've been disappointed at the lack of order members who engage in the political affairs of the day-to-day life within the country. I mean, how many order members write letters to the newspapers, putting forward a Dharma perspective on whatever issue arises? Hardly anybody. I used to write to the Age on a regular basis. Well, but not every letter got published by any means. But, you know, we're here. Thank you very much. And you should stop. You know, we should start sticking our flag in the ground and saying we're not going to be moving either. Yeah.